From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. America has always had its great dynastic families, the Roosevelts, the Kennedys, the Rockefellers. Dig a little into almost any corner of American life today, politics, entertainment, business, and you'll find even more. There's George W. and George H.W., Michael Powell and Colin Powell. Bill Ford Jr. sits in the driver's seat of the company founded by his great-grandfather, Henry Ford. Kirk and Michael Douglas make movies together, and maybe the grandkids will too. Then there's Nobel Prize-winning author Saul Bellow and his son, Adam. And it's Adam Bellow, a publishing bigwig in his own right, who says that American family dynasties, great and small, are enjoying a comeback, that we're now in a golden age of nepotism. And this new American nepotism, he argues, is a good thing. It's time for America to get over its nepotism gag reflex, he says. Nepotism is natural. It strengthens cultural traditions. It forms an elite that is necessary for any society. And since people are going to practice it anyway, Adam Bellow says in his new book, In Praise of Nepotism, we might as well acknowledge the new nepotism and, with a shot of meritocracy, keep it honest. The question is, what's the difference between new nepotism and plain old-fashioned aristocracy? Do you see a new nepotism in your field, your workplace, your family? Are we headed for a new dynastic era? Have we already got one? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from New York is Adam Bellow, editor-at-large at Doubleday and author of In Praise of Nepotism, A Natural History. Good evening and welcome, Adam Bellow.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
Thank you.
Adam Bellow, you stand in a legacy line yourself, but you're describing a kind of national phenom here of nepotism on a comeback trail, or more than that. What's the evidence?
Well, I didn't realize when I started to research this book about 4 years ago just how current the trend really was. You'll recall that around 1998, when I began to write the book, mm-hmm. George Bush and Al Gore squared off against each other for the presidential nomination. And it was at that point that the national press began to pay more and more attention to the persistence of family names and family traditions, first in politics, but then the circle of inquiry widened and continued to widen and took in more and more fields. Business, of course, where family traditions are well established and accepted, but also, and more, I think, strangely and provocatively to Americans, in professions that have generally been considered more merit-based, not just the cultural world of literature, but also in sports and even to some extent in the sciences and professions like journalism, medicine, and law.
To take us for a little bit of a cook's tour to help fill out the picture of what you see as examples of nepotism, the new nepotism here, before we come around to examining the why of it. There's George Bush, and there was George Bush before. Take us on to some of these categories.
Well, of course, before George, the present George Bush is a third-generation politician. His grandfather was a senator from Connecticut. Al Gore's father was a senator from Tennessee. And there is a tremendous number of political successors in both parties, and not just, by the way, members of the old line WASP elite. There are some people in Congress whose families have been there for 200 years or thereabouts. But also many people who come from the middle class, from ethnic backgrounds. There's someone like Jesse Jackson Jr., for example, mm-hmm. Or Lucille Roy Bell Allard. There is no class boundary or ethnic boundary to nepotism. It's very widely practiced. Now, that's just politics.
Well, politics is even richer than you've laid out there so far, though you've written it. But you've got Elaine Chao, the head of the Labor Department, wife of Senator Mitch McConnell. Take us on through here. Eugene Scalia,
right. There's several Supreme Court offspring in the Bush administration. Janet Rehnquist just resigned from her position at HHS. The Bush administration is a particularly dense cluster of successors, but there are also
Elizabeth
plenty.
Elizabeth Cheney, the vice president's daughter, deputy assistant secretary of state. And, of course, Michael Powell, head of the FCC, son of Colin Powell.
Correct.
And you say President Bush rolled over, or call it what you will, for Senator Strom Thurmond's son, appointed 28-year-old U.S. attorney for South Carolina, and right on down.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it goes on, and it's not just at the national level, but it continues and is, in fact, even more prominent at the state and local level. You have very famous local political dynasties. Consider the Dailies of Chicago, for example, or the current mayor of Los Angeles. It would take up an entire hour of your time to list everyone.
Just
in
listing
politics.
The names. Well, take us on then to some of these merit-based categories. What do you see going on there?
Well, look at the literature, for example. I think this is a particularly revealing example, and it happens to be the one in which my family business is found. There have always been a certain number of family traditions in literature. You can probably name a few yourself. The Bronte sisters, for example. Thomas Mann and his brother were both writers. But I noticed that there has been a very pronounced increase in the number of literary successors. I'll just list a few. Martin Amis, for example. Kingsley Amis's son. Mm-hmm. Brian Herbert, the son of the author of Dune, who has published a trilogy of what are called prequels to his father's novel. Mm-hmm. Christopher Tolkien has also published books in his father's tradition. Molly Jong Fast is the child of two writers and the granddaughter of a third. Mm-hmm. John McPhee has two daughters and a niece who publish books. Christopher Buckley, of course, the son of William F. Buckley. Susan and Ben Cheever, both the children of John Cheever. Gautama Chopra, who is the son of Deepak Chopra, Carol Higgins Clark, Frank and Malachi McCourt, Christopher Rice.
And this in a field where, as you say, one would expect that merit would be all.
Well, of course, the test of the market is the ultimate test. Not all of these people are equally talented. It's clear that they have increased access and opportunities to publish. And I think as the literary marketplace becomes more mass market oriented, it tends to be more responsive to brand name recognition. And I think this is something that publishers clearly understand. I work in the publishing business, so I have some experience.
So you see it up close. And so the family brand works here right across categories: politics, business, TV, entertainment, sports, even literature. Publishing. What's your analysis of this, Annabella? You've got a big case that you're making here that there's a kind of resurgence in spite of the sort of revolutionary dictate of the United States of America to be apart from, I think, what an awful lot of Americans associate with an old world tradition of nepotism and closely associated with aristocracy.
Well, you're right. It is a contradictory phenomenon, and it is difficult to explain in a few words, but I will try. Clearly, the American attitude towards nepotism has always been a negative one, going back to the Revolution, which was in many respects a kind of a family quarrel between the English colonists and the mother parliament and the tyrannical royal father, who was much attacked by the colonists, who really wished to be recognized as mature and adult sons and equals in their own right. So there was always, I think, a built-in bias against nepotism, which really, I think, is a matter of ideology. That is, as Republicans and Democrats, we have always felt, as Americans, that it is better for people to make it on their own merits, to strike out on their own, to establish themselves in life based on their accomplishments. And this is very important. It's not only important in terms of determining social outcomes, but also to the self-respect of American individuals. After all, nobody wants to be accused of practicing nepotism, but it's even worse to be accused of being a beneficiary of nepotism, because it undermines the claim that we all feel we have to make, that we have arrived in life at our present position due to our own merits.
But stood on our own two feet. But we're going to come back to the details, but you make the case here that this resurgence of nepotism is actually a good thing, and that the United States, despite the ideology of its founding, ought to kind of, I don't know, as you describe it, kind of mature and embrace a new nepotism. Why?
Well, it's again, it's a complicated question. I think that looking at the history of nepotism, which is which I think I'm the first person to even attempt to do, and I must say in preface that I make no claim to scholarship. I'm not a social scientist. I have not made an empirical study.
But the field's been left pretty wide open for you. You point out that it hasn't been given much scientific study.
Well, it hasn't been given any study at all, and that's the first and most, I think, most remarkable fact about nepotism. You'd think that something this pervasive would have been exhaustively studied by now in some branch of social science, but it just seems to be something that nobody wants to study for some reason. And I think that that in itself is significant because it suggests to my mind that there's a great deal of simple hypocrisy surrounding the practice of nepotism. That is to say, and this gets to your question of whether nepotism is actually increasing or not. It's a little bit difficult to say because I think you could make the argument, I think you can make the argument that there is a new nepotism, a distinctly modern form of nepotism that reflects the a balance between two principles of equal value and validity, that is to say the merit principle and the principle of family tradition, with both of which we respect. But at the same time, it's also evident that a lot of the nepotism that has traditionally gone on in our society has not been noticed or has been actively concealed because it is, frankly, an embarrassment to people.
Well, and the culture has set it up as an embarrassment, as a kind of barricade against rampant nepotism, hasn't it? I mean, isn't that kind of baked in the American cake from the very beginning?
Yes, of course. I mean, America claims to be an exceptional nation, and I'm not I don't mean to contest that.
You say that the country is getting older now. And as it gets older, as I read you, Adam Bell, you're saying this is a kind of youthful, immature notion. Of course, nepotism or family dynasties will emerge, and we shouldn't be hung up in that sort of silly ideology of our national founding. We should see the merits of nepotism. I must say, it's still hard for me. I guess I've still got that nepotism gag reflex.
Well, it's a natural thing. I mean, it's and very understandable, and in fact, it's necessary. It's one of the things that protects us from abuses of nepotism is the fact that people are, in fact, tend to get angry about it when it's pointed out. But at the same time, I find that the anger about nepotism is very selective. And that cases of favoritism to family members sometimes seem fine to us as long as that person appears to be qualified. I'll give you an example. I noticed in the New York Times a couple of years ago that Laila Ali, who was then, I think, 23 years old.
Muhammad Ali's daughter.
Muhammad Ali's daughter, yes, announced that she wanted to enter the world of women's boxing. And this story was front page news in the New York Times with a beautiful color picture of the young woman. And a long article all about her desire to form a connection with her father, who had divorced her mother when she was young.
And this sounds celebratory.
Yes, it was a very celebratory story. And way down at the bottom of the story, somebody was interviewed, another female boxer, someone who didn't have that famous name in family tradition. And she was asked how she felt about it. And she said, she expressed what I think is a very typical and reasonable and even generous attitude that Americans really, really share, which is, hey, fine, if she needs to use her name to get a leg up in this business, that's okay, because life is tough and everybody uses whatever advantages they have, and that no one should have to apologize for that. In any case, the ultimate test is going to be in the ring. And it's all very well. This is the classic instance of getting your foot in the door, but having to stand up against whatever comes.
But it's an awfully big name to ride into the sport on, Muhammad Ali. Jack Beattie, I can just hear you chomping on your bit there. We're going to get to you just after the break. We are talking tonight about America's new nepotism. A Son of Fame makes the case for family dynasties. Our guest is Adam Bello. He's author of the new book, In Praise of Nepotism. You can join the conversation. Are you ready to soften up on nepotism, or does it still give you the all-American willies? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America's new nepotism. A son of fame with us tonight makes the case for family dynasties. Our guest is Adam Bellow. He's author of the new book, In Praise of Nepotism, A Natural History. You can join the conversation tonight. Is nepotism just a derogatory term for a universal fact of life? Do American ideals require that Americans resist nepotism, or is it time to accept, even embrace it? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jack Beatty, here's Adam Bellow saying, hey, it is a fact of life, and you know what? It's not so bad. Now, where does that put your nepotism gag reflex, Jack Beatty?
Well, I think he's really put his finger on something in the age of Bush. I mean, America's getting to be a lot like the House of Lords. No damn nonsense about merit. You know, the aristocratic principle offends against equality, and it's a source of mediocrity. Let's take the first. David Parter, the historian, says that Americans' idea of equality is equality in competition. And I think he's very right about that. Well, let's do a little thought experiment. Suppose a guy named Beatty and a guy named, I don't know, Bellow, go to New York to try to get a job with a publisher. And all other things more or less are equal in their resume. Who you know, if you were to bet who would get the job, I'd put my dime on Bellow. Equality in competition? No. Then mediocrity. Now, Bellow, I'm sure he's a very successful publisher. But, you know, this hasn't been an era, this era of rampant nepotism has coincided with an era of downward mobility, an era of slow economic growth, an era of sclerotic bureaucracies, and both in business and in government, and the promotion of people just because they have connections as opposed to they have some ability is a way that a society lards itself up with mediocrities. This happened to the British. This was one of the reasons why the British, their economic performance just declined over years, because every Cadbury, you take a look at the chart of Cadbury's chocolate. I mean, my God, unto the guy that cleaned the floor, they were all Cadbury's.
But Jack, Adam Bellow says it's a new kind of nepotism and it requires merit, that it doesn't live without merit as it might have in the old days.
Well, I mean, we have to see the proof of that. I mean, it's who gets in the door, and equality in competition ain't there when it's Bellow versus Beatty.
But is it possible that you may not agree with his even embrace of this, but that he's describing something that really is happening?
Oh, I'm saying it absolutely is happening, and now it's being institutionalized. Under George Bush, we're going to abolish the inheritance tax. Think what that means. That means when Bill Gates's kids die, say Bill Gates has $50 billion. Under the current law, he'd have to pay about $20 billion of that to the government. That $20 billion, all of it is going to go to his kids. We're never going to have an aristocracy quite like the one we're going to have in the lees of the age of Bush.
So, Adam Bellow, there's the attack on the new nepotism. Let's hear your defense of it. You make one.
Well, you know, it's difficult to defend an abstract proposition.
Well, don't go soft on us now. We can quote you chapter and verse defending it. Right. So let us hear it.
Well, I would say what Jack is talking about is the perennial problem of the formation of classes, castes, elites, which is a pronatural process of society, and it is controversial in a democracy in which we value equal opportunity. My argument would be that we are protected in America against the abuse, against this process going too far, by several factors that are unique about in our society. And some which are not unique. For example, there is a general law of generational decline. The common phrase "shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves" in three generations is a piece of conventional wisdom that happens to be based in historical experience.
That is, some generation digs in and does something great; the next generation, maybe not quite so great, and by the third generation, they're back where they started.
Yes, I mean, it's not always the case, of course. With when tremendous wealth is amassed,
you lock in $20 billion, you could ride quite a while on that, I'd say.
That's right. But you see, each family has to make its own decisions. And in the case of Bill Gates is instructive, because In fact, contrary to what Jack has said, Bill Gates is on the record as saying that he intends to leave his children not only, let's say, a mere $10 million apiece.
And his family has campaigned against this. We get that. But he wouldn't have to if the estate tax is repealed.
Yes, but he'll do that anyway because he's concerned for his children's welfare. And the reason for this is that he understands, as Americans since Teddy Roosevelt have understood, that if people inherit too much money, it isn't good for them.
But Annabelle, you make the case that there's actually a kind of cultural benefit in nepotism sometimes. Define that.
Well, I think that we have to come to terms with the fact that there is a certain accumulation of not just of advantages in families, but also of cultural and ethical values. Nepotism, as I define it, is fundamentally a means of passing on knowledge and property and authority and cultural values from one generation to the next.
What's the difference between that and aristocracy?
Well, people are always afraid of aristocracy. And I think, particularly in America, I think this is a bogus red herring. There is no possibility of a real aristocracy being formed in this country. There's too much mass immigration, cultural and technological change. It's a very dynamic society. Of course, we are, you know, concerned at the moment, as we cyclically are, about concentrations of wealth and influence. But America has a tendency to churn and change, and I think ultimately, because we live in a democratic system and a free market system, ultimately we are protected from that kind of finally exclusive political or economic caste being formed.
Dominant. So in that context, you're saying, hey, nepotism is like the weather. Lay back and enjoy it. It's going to happen. Let's make the best of it. Is that the argument?
Well, I'm saying that we should take a longer view of it. I think, you know, we live in a time with, you know, obviously very polarizing sentiments. People are very passionate about politics these days, and the fact that that there are a lot of people in government named Bush makes it an obvious target for people who want to posture as populists. And I think that's, you know, understandable, but it's a somewhat short perspective. And if you look at the sweep of American history, I think you find that these things are cyclical and have a way of sorting themselves out.
But aren't there real built-in advantages here? One of the ways that I read you defining the new nepotism is that in the old nepotism, whether Johnny deserved it or not, he might be president of the company even if he wasn't very talented. In the new nepotism, you're saying merit's required. If not before you get the job, then after. But Jack, you know, puts the test there. If Beattie and Bellow show up at the publisher's door, Bellow's more likely to be hired. And doesn't that skew the equal opportunity right from the start?
Well, every industry or trade or pursuit has its families, its family traditions. And I'm happy to grant to Jack and concede the point that if he and I were in competition for a job and had no other qualifications other than our family backgrounds, I might beat him out. But the opposite could be said of us if we were competing in journalism or some other field where I don't have any advantage. In other words, you know, my social advantages, such as they are very narrow. But I think that what has been left out of the picture is the extent to which meritocratic values have been assimilated and absorbed by Americans in general. And as I said earlier, nobody wants to be accused of being a beneficiary of nepotism. You know, it's very like affirmative action, I think is a useful parallel. Like nepotism, affirmative action is often judged by the worst cases, by the few sort of bad apples, as it were. And this is something that other people who benefited from affirmative action and have earned their position and their advantages after the fact, as it were, feel very sensitive about. And I think the same thing can be said about nepotism.
But one is to equalize opportunity. The other one is in a way to hoard it. But it's a fascinating thesis. We have a lot of callers who want to join this conversation, Adam Bellow. If you'll allow us, I'd like to invite them in. Victor is calling from Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Victor. You're on the air.
Hi, how do you do?
Very well, thanks.
I was calling, I guess the comment I would make is I have the instant strong gag reflex with respect to nepotism as well, but I think some of second generation people who follow in the footsteps of their parents or their families develop perhaps a natural talent or a natural proclivity to, you know, to the activity that they've always seen, they've seen in the household. And so to some extent, perhaps, being a second generation in a particular line of business or in a particular sport or vocation simply naturally leads to the second generation being even better than the first.
So it sounds, Victor, like you're buying into this new nepotism. If they've got the stuff, if they've got the merit, you're prepared to grant the bit of advantage that they bring by family association?
I think I am. I think that my initial gag reflex is mitigated if somebody really shows they've got the stuff. The example I would use is Kobe Bryant. Mm-hmm. His father, Joe Bryant, you may recall, played for the Sixers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, here's a guy who has amazing natural ability. You know, he's been around the sport his whole life. I find it very pleasant to watch Kobe Bryant play, notwithstanding the fact that, you know, yeah, he probably had a lot of lubrication in terms of getting into that career path, you know. Mm-hmm. But when I look at something like Charlie Sheen or Kiefer Sutherland, I just want to throw up.
So why are they there?
Exactly. Those guys don't get auditions if they aren't the sons of famous actors. They're not even in the business. And that I guess that's the end of the day. You know, the question is, in terms of my personal judgment, maybe someone who got somewhere through nepotism needs to show me a little extra for me to kind of calm down about it. And it's ironic because right. I'm driving along in my car, and
yeah.
This has been a subject that has bothered me for the longest time. And I was absolutely astounded to find an actual talk show on the exact topic. And I just had to call in. I never call in.
Well, we're pressing all your buttons tonight, Victor, but it's great feedback, and we thank you for calling. Watch the white line there. Adam Bello, this sounds like Victor is sort of landing his craft right on the deck of your carrier here.
Well, Victor is expressing, I think, what is really a very common sentiment and a very reasonable one, because Americans are pragmatic people. We're not ideological, really. And the thing we understand is that you can't apply a single standard of judgment or behavior to every case. It's very difficult, as we know, to legislate these matters, especially in the sphere of nepotism, where really what you're talking about is parents wanting to do things for their children. I mean, this is a very basic impulse. It gets as basic as sex and aggression.
But it's so easily corrupted. It's so easily corrupted. I mean, as Victor was saying, one instance, maybe Kobe Bryant, you say, here, and another, well, it looks like all the name. And after a few generations, so many of us came from continents where inherited privilege was a monstrous problem that had lasted for centuries, and this country was the magic way out of it. I mean, my family certainly felt that way. You couldn't mention the name of Swedish royalty in the house, you know, because those were the aristocrats who had left them in famine. It wasn't
funny. We have a lot invested in this country in the idea that we are completely different from every other society.
Well, it's more than an idea, at least at the start. I mean, a lot of people were drawn by something more than an idea, weren't they? It was an actual fact.
Well, it's just a land of opportunity, but not of perfect equality. Now, I'm not saying that by any means. I'm really not trying to say that everything people believe is wrong and that nepotism is really good. What I'm saying is that there is a distinction that needs to be made between good nepotism and bad nepotism. This is the distinction that has never been made in our society, and I think it's what our caller was really mm-hmm. was really groping towards. He was perfectly capable of making the distinction for himself.
Jack Beatty, can you see the American culture riding the waves of privilege successfully along this line of distinction between new nepotism and or good nepotism and bad nepotism?
No, but I think people will just simply get used to it. That's the world we live in, where this is everyone recognizes increasingly in the economy. It's connections. A study of executives a few years ago showed that something like 75% of them got their jobs through connections. And a study of non-executives who got just ordinary jobs found that 75% of them thought that was not a good idea. So obviously, if you want to succeed in life, use your connections. The point is, the whole idea of equality of opportunity has decayed in America as the egalitarian institutions that sustained it have decayed. Unions, strong public schools, a strong public sector. All of these things are in decay, and they supported a kind of mobility. Now, Adam mentioned that. There was a study by a couple of economists last fall. American social and economic mobility is now vying with England's as one of the slowest in the as the lowest in the industrial world. That's since the 1970s. Now, we all recognize that since the 70s we've become a more unequal society. But one of the ways we become unequal is precisely because these positions are occupied, are already, the fix is already in for people with the right name. And that means that people who might have got those positions, gotten those positions, can't. And that's a form, that's a loss of mobility. And that's one of the contributing factors to this ossification, to this slowdown in economic mobility in the United States, which is really calling into question the whole idea of the American middle class.
But Jack, Adam Bello describes nepotism in a way as just good, responsible parenting.
Sure. But he wants to dignify it. He wants to tart it up with virtue. There's nothing virtuous about it. It is eminently Darwinian. You're just looking for the future success of your genes. I mean, it is the ultimate in selfishness, not selflessness.
Adam Bello, are you tarting up selfishness here?
I think it's interesting that that Jack mentions the labor unions as a guarantor of social opportunity, equal opportunity, because, of course, as he knows very well, labor unions were products mostly of ethnic communities, and in fact were built out of nepotism. And as a matter of fact, most of the unions created at the beginning of the 20th century were called father-son unions because they had in their charters a clause guaranteeing that the first opportunity for new positions in the union would go to the children of union members. So my point would be a historical one. I'm not really arguing from principle, but from history. And the point is that nepotism has been the way. I mean, we have a view of nepotism as something that's only practiced by the rich, as a way of keeping their incompetent, idiotic sons off the streets and keeping the poor in their place. But the fact is that nepotism has been practiced just as widely and is, in fact, even more important for the working and immigrant classes.
That's an interesting point. We want to come back and talk about it. Adam Bello, author of The In Praise of Nepotism, please stand by. Listeners, we're talking about America's new nepotism. You can join the conversation. Do you see nepotism in your field, in your workplace? Is it a good thing or a bad thing? Do you want to see more dynastic families in American life? Are we headed for a new aristocracy, or have we already got it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America's new nepotism with a son of fame making the case for family dynasties. Our guest is Adam Bello. He joins us tonight from New York. He's author of the new book, In Praise of Nepotism, A Natural History. You can join the conversation. Are you ready to soften up on nepotism, or does it still give you the all-American willies? Is it just a derogatory term for a universal fact of life? Does a new nepotism mean America has grown up or lost its way? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Carolyn's calling from Hanover, Massachusetts. Hi, Carolyn. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a couple things to say. One of my comments, similar to Victor's who called earlier.
Yes.
You talked about the Brontes and the Cheevers, you know, famous writers.
In the literary vein,
families.
Yep.
Yes. And I think that's a good case for nepotism because things really do run in the family, and writing talent can be one of those things, and I think each of the Brontes is a good writer in her own right. And along those same lines, more people would like to. Sorry, I'm not very articulate.
Let me ask you just on that piece first, then. If you believe that these talents run in family lines and can be nurtured in family lines, then is it a greater social good to kind of hold up that next and third and fourth generation, however long it lasts? Or does that run against another great good of democracy and egalitarianism?
I think it depends. If you have a talent that can be nurtured and you think it's a part of your genetics, then, you know, more power to you. However, you know, if you marry and have children and that child marries again, you're slowly just going to breed the talent out of the family.
So you think it's genetic then?
I think there's genetic aspects, and I'm sure your surroundings are a part of it too.
But it sounds like you're ready to acknowledge it and maybe even to accept it or to hold it up as something that we should value. Carolyn, thanks for calling in. Adam Bellow, is that the point you're making?
Well, I think this is, again, she's demonstrating the same American generosity of spirit and pragmatism that makes possible what we are calling the new nepotism. I mean, everybody understands that. I mean, I understand the objections to bad nepotism as well as anybody else, and I'm certainly not promoting it, although I do spend a fair amount of time in my book explaining that it did make important contributions to human evolution and social development. But now we're in a situation in this country where you really can't practice the old nepotism in the old traditional way. It's very difficult, really, to even when you want to help your children in any direct way. And part of that difficulty is, as I said before, that they don't really want to be helped, or at least they don't want to feel that they're being helped in a way that undermines their self-respect and their self-image as strong, independent, autonomous people.
And you're saying they won't last if they don't have competence anyway. But you do acknowledge that the nepotism chain gets them through the door, that their proof in the pudding comes after they've got the job very often, not before, like a person without that advantage.
I think that's exactly what happens. And as Victor said earlier, you know, when he said, I want to see a little extra effort from the Michael Douglases and Kiefer Sutherlands, that's exactly what the young beneficiaries of the new nepotism feel about themselves. Now, they don't all measure up, and I'm not, again, I wouldn't want to be in a position of giving a blanket endorsement to everybody who follows in their parents' tradition. Everybody has to be judged on their merits.
But you're quite generous in granting them that access through the door. I mean, you know, getting through the door is half the battle. A lot of the time, as you well know, it's a pretty remarkable advantage to begin with.
Sure, and I agree with what Jack said earlier that this is a society in which connections are very important and perhaps increasingly important. I'm not saying that that's something we shouldn't be concerned about. I'm saying it's something that I'm not terribly mm-hmm. concerned about, because I've seen from my study of history that this kind of thing waxes and wanes with time. And I think ultimately the test of the market is the best protection that we have against the creation of artificial barriers that really do exclude or would exclude talented nobodies, let's say, from making it in their chosen profession.
Mm, nobodies. Hmm. Al is calling from Waltham, Massachusetts. Hi, Al. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Mr. Bellow, Mr. Beatty. I would like to make a comment about something that I think is more important in the nepotism. It's worse, let me say, in, shall we say, business or politics, things where money matters and you might get the position regardless of your other qualifications.
Regardless of your talent, you mean?
Exactly. Regardless of talent. Whereas in a thing like, say, Christopher Tolkien, if he doesn't write books as well as his father, then, you know, people might buy his first book and then they're not going to buy his books anymore. Or if Kobe Bryant can't play ball and he just got in, you know, to basketball because that's what his dad did, but he's not actually very good at it, then he's not going to last in the sport very long.
But have you seen examples of people in business who can somehow sustain?
I'll give you two specific examples that I've seen in my past. I spent a year working in Holland for a large international consulting company.
Mm-hmm.
And someone was brought in to manage an entire department because he was the president of the company's son.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a PhD in physics. He had no experience managing people, wasn't really good at managing people, and there were several people under him who essentially had to carry him and do his job for him because he wasn't any good at it.
So does the same thing happen in the United States, Al?
I think it can happen in the United States. I have another example of a company I worked for in the U.S. where that didn't happen. Where you had there's a local newspaper here in Boston, a nightly, you know, not pulp, but magazine that comes out weekly. And the you know, owner of that company has his son who he's freely will admit that he's grooming to take over the company. But his son really wants to do it. His son has gone into school to learn about the business. He's learned about the business all his life because his dad runs it.
So he's putting in the effort, and you'll give him that green light there. Al, our time is running down, but I want to thank you for calling in with those observations. Adam Bello, you mentioned nepotism getting down, not even up in the grand kind of celebrity realm of life, but down in more ordinary professions and in less glamorous or high-paid lives. Do you see this as just becoming, I don't know, a new American way that children will follow in the groove laid by their parents?
Well, I think that it used to be, of course, traditional that you did what your parents, what your father did. Your mother didn't have a profession. And that was natural and expected for many years. And then we went through a long period in about a century or more in this country where people were encouraged to move on and move up and to strive and do better than their parents. In fact, it's the American dream to provide a better life for your children than you had yourself. And that's really been the great engine of American dynamism and prosperity. And I'm not quarreling with that at all. What I'm just observing is that there has been a change. There is a kind of clearly a return of interest in family tradition. And family tradition is something that I think what I'm saying is that we're just sort of schizophrenic about this question, because we're suspicious about nepotism and worried about it, but we also understand and respect family tradition. And when people pursue the family line, we often praise them and reward them for it.
Well, long live the suspicion, I say, and if people can break through and prove themselves in spite of it, maybe that's the test. Adam Bello, I want to thank you for joining us tonight. It's been a very interesting conversation, and thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Adam Bello is author of In Praise of Nepotism in Natural History. Where are we headed here, Jack?
Can I put in my nepotistic plug?
Oh, yes, please.
A version of Mr. Bello's very interesting book appears in The Atlantic Monthly month.
There's a bit of direct nepotism.
There you go.
You'll be richly rewarded for this plug,
I'm looking forward to it.
Jack. Anything you want to say about your children while we're at it?
No, but I'm very glad of the inheritance my father left me. He left me a 1973 Plymouth with eczema on the roof and a very good name.
Wow, Jack, it's an honorable beginning, and we're proud of what you've made of it. Thanks for being with us tonight, Jack.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online, whatever your name may be, at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, President George W. Bush laments America's slave-owning past during his trip to Africa. This is On Point. President Bush today gave a wide-ranging speech on slavery and race relations at Gore Island, the African seaport where slaves were once packed onto ships and sent to America. Bush called slavery one of the great crimes of history and lamented that a republic founded on equality for all became a prison for millions. The president added that the lessons America has learned about slavery need to inform its relationship with Africa today. The speech came on the first day of Bush's five-day trip to Africa. Here is more of what the president had to say off the coast of Senegal.
We can fairly judge the past by the standards of President John Adams, who called slavery an evil of colossal magnitude. We can discern eternal standards in the deeds of William Wilberforce and John Quincy Adams and Harriet Beecher Stowe and Abraham Lincoln. These men and women, black and white, burned with a zeal for freedom, and they left behind a different and better nation. Their moral vision caused Americans to examine our hearts, to correct our Constitution, and to teach our children the dignity and equality of every person, of every race. By a plan known only to Providence, the stolen sons and daughters of Africa helped to awaken the conscience of America. The very people traded into slavery helped to set America free. In the struggle of the centuries, America learned that freedom is not the possession of one race. This belief in the natural rights of man, this conviction that justice should reach wherever the sun passes, leads America into the world. With the power and resources given to us, the United States seeks to bring peace where there is conflict, hope where there's suffering, and liberty where there's tyranny. And these commitments bring me and other distinguished leaders of my government across the Atlantic to Africa. African peoples are now writing your own story of liberty. Africans have overcome the arrogance of colonial powers, overturned the cruelties of apartheid, and made it clear that dictatorship is not the future of any nation on this continent. Because Africans and Americans share a belief in the values of liberty and dignity, we must share in the labor of advancing those values. In a time of growing commerce across the globe, we will ensure that the nations of Africa are full partners in the trade and prosperity of the world. Against the waste and violence of civil war, we will stand together for peace. Against the merciless terrorists who threaten every nation, we will wage an unrelenting campaign of justice. Confronted with desperate hunger, we will answer with human compassion and the tools of human technology. In the face of spreading disease, we will join with you in turning the tide against AIDS in Africa. We know that these challenges can be overcome because history moves in the direction of justice. The evils of slavery were accepted and unchanged for centuries. Yet eventually the human heart would not abide them. There is a voice of conscience and hope in every man and woman that will not be silenced. What Martin Luther King called a certain kind of fire that no water could put out. That flame could not be extinguished at the Birmingham jail. It could not be stamped out at Robben Island prison. It was seen in the darkness here at Gory Island, where no chain could bind the soul. This untamed fire of justice continues to burn in the affairs of man, and it lights the way before us.
President Bush speaking earlier today on Gory Island in Senegal. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.